and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Donald Trump's America First speech before the UN today, in which he threatened to totally destroy North Korea. Joseph Cerincione, the president of the Plowshares Fund and author of Bomb Scare, The History and Future of Nuclear Weapons, joins us to discuss how extraordinarily lucky we have been that no nuclear weapon has ever been used in anger since Nagasaki in 1945, and the recent passing of the man who saved the world, a former Soviet military officer, Lieutenant Colonel Stanislav Petrov, who in September of 1983 decided that the alarm bells from the early warning system detecting five American Minuteman missiles heading for the Soviet Union was a computer error, and thus the world was saved from an accidental nuclear war because he defied orders and overrode an automatic massive Soviet retaliation. Now, with the growing possibility that the U.S. could stumble into a nuclear war with North Korea, we will look into Trump's belligerent stance on the world stage and discuss the dinner that our guest attended last night with the president of Iran. Then we'll assess how much the noose is tightening around top Trump officials, including Trump's former campaign manager, Paul Manafort, who was under enormous pressure from the special counsel investigating Russian meddling in the election since Manafort was told that he will be indicted. Robert Dreyfus, a contributing editor to The Nation and an independent investigative journalist specializing in politics and national security, joins us to discuss his latest article at Rolling Stone, Russiagate Dominoes Are Starting to Fall, and how Manafort has been under CIA and FBI surveillance since 2014 up until recently, which means that it is very likely the government has transcripts of phone calls between Trump and Manafort. Then finally, we'll speak with Wendell Potter, a former chief corporate spokesman for Cigna and head of corporate communications for Humana, who is now a senior analyst on healthcare at the Center for Public Integrity and founder of Tarbell.org. He joins us to discuss his latest article at Truthout, Even Business Leaders Are Realizing Health Insurance Companies Serve No Purpose, and how two Republican senators who voted against the last effort to repeal Obamacare are wavering under pressure to go along with the hideous and cruel Graham Cassidy bill. And joining us now is Joseph Cerincione, who's the president of the Plowshares Fund and the author of Bomb Scare, The History and Future of Nuclear Weapons. He worked on the professional staffs of the House Committee on Armed Services and the Committee on Government Operations and served as staff director of the Bipartisan Military Reform Caucus. Welcome to Background Briefing, Joseph Cerincione.
It's a pleasure to be back, Ian.
As it happens, Joe, just yesterday we learned of the death of Stanislav Petrov, a lieutenant colonel in the Soviet missile forces who, back in September of 1983, saved the world. He's often referred to as the man who saved the world because he saw five Minuteman missiles coming from the U.S. towards Russia and didn't do what the protocol required, which was to automatically launch the retaliation, because he thought it could have been a computer error, which it turned out to be. This is a way to say that we're very lucky to have survived the Cold War without a nuclear war. Luck played a greater part, and there have been many, many near misses. So in the context of nuclear weapons, given the statements made today at the UN by Donald Trump, it is so obvious that we have been lucky that a nuclear weapon hasn't been used in anger since Nagasaki. But my sense is that it's bad enough to have a nuclear war on purpose, but to have one by accident is unconscionable. And the way that Trump is ramping up the rhetoric with the equally bombastic Kim Jong-un would indicate to me that we could stumble into a nuclear war.
That's absolutely correct, and Colonel Petrov's courageous actions have prevented one at a time of maximum tension, 1983, between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. The U.S. was conducting massive military exercises that we now know the Soviet leadership thought was a cover for an invasion, so they were on edge. And when Petrov got that radar blip, he decided not to report it. If he had reported it, it's almost certain that the Soviets would have seen it as an attack and would have launched their nuclear weapons. So that's why they call him the man that saved the world. Those kinds of accidents can happen again, and the kinds of tensions we're seeing on the Korean Peninsula could cause another a close call, or worse, an actual war.
I wish the news was better today, but Donald Trump said some pretty provocative things before the United Nations today in New York. He basically made a joke, which I don't think went down well, calling Kim Jong-un a rocket man and saying rocket man's on a suicide mission for himself and for the regime. And then he said the U.S. will have no choice but to totally destroy North Korea. Has anybody ever said anything quite that belligerent before the world body? Even Khrushchev banging his shoe. Does that rise to the same occasion? What's your reading on that?
You have to go back to Nikita Khrushchev to find an example. I'm someone who's with that kind of bombast and belligerence. And of course, Khrushchev was widely mocked for that and lost considerable credibility, even among his own, the ruling elite of the Soviet Union. He was later pulled out of the leadership in part because of that kind of behavior. No American president has ever done anything remotely like this, ridiculed an adversary like this, threatened the complete destruction of another country. This goes way beyond a deterrence posture, way beyond a display of American strength. I'm sure it went over very well with his base, who likes this kind of talk, the America First crowd. And in some ways, that's who he was speaking to. He's using the UN sort of as a prop, the way he has with other institutions, like including the CIA, and it's very first week in office. No, this didn't do anything to enhance U.S. credibility. If anything, it further distanced us from our allies. I don't think anybody was impressed with the president's performance today.
Well, indeed, he did hail strong sovereign nations and called on world leaders to put your country first and was unapologetically an American firster. But I don't believe to his...
Right, and he's saying this, he's speaking at an international body that is dedicated to international cooperation, where the whole purpose of the United Nations is to have people go beyond their individual national interests. Talk about a tone-deaf speech. You could tell it was written by an inexperienced young man, Stephen Miller, with this kind of rigid ideological view of the U.S. role in the world.
Well, what's your sense then of how we're going to get out from under this? It's not just Trump that's making these belligerent statements about North Korea. Here's Nikki Haley, his U.N. rep, even General Mattis, alluded to the possibility that there are military options. And as you know, Trump, when he made his fire and fury remark, the North Koreans were a little alarmed, that they backed off for a little bit. And then that was undercut by Stephen Bannon in an interview with the American Prospect, where he basically said there's nothing we can do about North Korea. They've got us because of 10 million people hostage in Seoul. So what's going on here? Is there something that we're missing in this picture in terms of whether a preemptive nuclear strike on North Korea or a military strike on North Korea has any military utility and won't result in a 10 million casualties or less, or whatever. I mean, won't result in Seoul being vaporized. And I imagine if you were to evacuate Seoul, that would put the North Koreans on notice and they would preempt. So I just don't get that military picture that they're alluding to, that there's some Buck Rogers way of solving this problem.
No, you're not missing anything. There are military options, but there are no military solutions. There are things we can do. There's no question we can hit North Korea. You could just, dial your level of destruction that you'd like to place on it. The question is what happens next. And North Korea is not Syria. You hit North Korea, they hit back. And Seoul, a city of 25 million people, is within artillery range of we estimate 10,000 rockets and tubes, artillery tubes, that are dug into the mountains overlooking Seoul. They could place about 5,000 artillery pieces, shells, in the first 10 minutes of a conflict. So the estimates are that hundreds of thousands of South Koreans would die. There is no, in the first few hours, there's no way you can wipe out that kind of capability before they retaliate. So this tough talk, you know, sounds good, sounds to the base, but it actually made America weaker. One, it's not going to intimidate the North Koreans. If anything, this strengthens Kim Jong-un's hand. He says we're under attack. The reason I'm doing all this is because America wants to attack us. Therefore, we have to go ahead with the missile and nuclear program. So it strengthens his position, probably his resolve. Two, it freaks out the South Koreans. I've already heard from friends who were talking to the South Koreans since then, and they're nervous about what Trump is doing. They're nervous that he might do something unwise that, of course, would cost them their lives. The Chinese are getting nervous about Trump, not about North Korea, but about what he might do. And finally, three, I understand that I've talked to friends who have reason to know this, that in the meetings with Trump, his national security team keeps telling him there's no good military option, but he keeps demanding one. He's frustrated. He's angry. He wants there to be some quick fix. So what the military has been telling him, and Secretary of Defense Mattis, is that if we're going to do something like this, first, we have to prepare. We have to move forces to the area. It would take us a month or more, or 2 months, to move the significant U.S. forces to the area to prepare for a major attack on North Korea. And, of course, we'd have to start evacuating U.S. civilians from South Korea. We estimate there's some 200,000 Americans living in South Korea. And all this, you know, in an effort to slow Trump down. Is there a master plan here? Not that anybody can see. There is no strategy for what to do. There is no plan for negotiations. So far, it's tweets and bombast.
And again, I'm speaking with Joseph Cirincione, who's the president of the Plowshares Fund and author of Bomb Scare, The History and Future of Nuclear Weapons. He worked on the professional staffs of the House Committee on Armed Services and the Committee on Government Operations and served as staff director of the Bipartisan Military Reform Caucus. Well, of course, Donald Trump, you know, you mentioned Stephen Miller, this extreme right-wing neophyte who writes these speeches, having a peculiar worldview and little or no experience in politics. And then on top of that, you have Trump himself, who just recently tweeted out that since these UN sanctions were brought about, there have been long gas queues for cars lining up in North Korea. Well, first of all, there aren't really that many cars in North Korea. But it just shows you that he just make stuff up, and you know he's not dealing with the reality. And of course, the South Koreans seem to be an afterthought in all of these military strategies. When you say we'd evacuate American civilians, what would the South Koreans do? Twiddle their thumbs while it's clear that the country's about to enter a Holocaust?
Well, that's exactly right. That's when you see the real panic. You know, the South Koreans have been living under a very real threat of North Korean military aggression for some time. It's somewhat new to America now that North Korea has tested a missile that can reach the continental United States and now tested a hydrogen bomb that is many times more powerful than their previous bombs. You know, there is actually a direct threat from North Korea to the United States, but the South Koreans have been living under this for years. First, the conventional threat, which is by itself enough to cause a war that would kill millions of South Koreans. And then for about 8 or so years now, since North Korea clearly developed a nuclear weapon and has 1,000 or more short-range rockets that could carry that weapon to South Korea, they've been living under the nuclear threat. So they haven't been particularly nervous by the recent North Korean activity. They don't like it. They'd like it to stop. It angers them. But you haven't seen the kind of panic in South Korea. What makes them nervous is Trump. And what they're nervous about isn't so much that Trump would intentionally start a war, but this kind of bombast, this kind of maneuvering. But I just finished a meeting of experts here in our offices today. We had about 15 experts on North Korea, and what all of us are concerned about is stumbling into war. a kind of 1914 scenario where one side or the other makes a move that's intended to signal determination and strength, but the other side interprets as an imminent risk of conflict, and therefore they make a counter move, and it escalates quickly into a war that no one really wanted or thought could happen. And so what you're worried about is Trump doing something that Kim Jong-un sees as an imminent attack, a planned decapitation strike, which is an exercise we practice all the time. Just yesterday, B-1 bombers flew practice runs from Guam over South Korean targets, practicing bombing North Korean targets. And if Kim thinks he's under imminent threat, that he then strikes first, and that's it. That's the spark that starts off the war. That's, I think, the greatest danger at this point.
Well, the decapitation strategy doesn't make any sense if you actually understand that country. And recently, the New Yorker's Evan Esnos wrote an extremely interesting piece. For example, he visits a little school in North Korea where they show him endless pictures of the time that Kim Jong-un visited the school. I mean, you know, thousands of shots of this guy walking down the corridor. And apparently Kim touched a kid's blanket. Well, they put that blanket in a glass case, you know, as though it was some religious icon. This is emperor worship that's going on in that country. You cut off the head, the whole country mourns. It's not like they're going to this surrender. I mean, maybe the Chinese could engineer some kind of coup via the military if they have those contacts, assuming that they probably more than anybody would have the contacts. But at the end of the day, there's no way to remove this regime by simply cutting off the head, is there, without the rest of the body lashing out?
And lashing out in unpredictable ways. So it might not be that they lash out as one, as it all, as a smooth transition, say, to the next level of leadership. It very likely could end up being a civil war. You knock out the leadership, you still have a million-person army, and you still have a massive amount of military equipment. You could be looking at the very real prospect of a civil war as a struggle for control goes underway. This is actually the scenario that worries China. This is why they're willing to put more sanctions on North Korea, but they want to know what the end game is. They want to know that there's a negotiated solution, that the sanctions are pressure in order to get a negotiated solution. They are never going to solve the problem for us the way President Trump wants by crippling sanctions that would attempt to cause the collapse of North Korea. That's their nightmare scenario. They don't like North Korea having nuclear weapons, but what they really don't like is a collapsed North Korea with nuclear weapons.
Well, let's, in the last couple of minutes, Joseph Cerenziani, turn to the UN speech by Donald Trump. And the other aspect of it, of course, was he talked about this terrible nuclear deal with Iran, which he's mentioned on many occasions, calling it one of the worst and most one-sided transactions the U.S. has ever entered into and an embarrassment. And this in front of the world body. Of course, the day before he met with Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel, who is very hawkish on the idea, and it does seem as if the Saudis and the Israelis want the U.S. to go to war with Iran and do their dirty work for them. And in talking to reporters after the meeting with Netanyahu, asked about the fate of the nuclear deal, Trump said, "You'll see very soon." So it's pretty clear that he's looking for a way to get out from under the deal and may well use the Congress as a way to, you know, take his fingerprints off it, because they have also a route to take to get out of the deal. But you had dinner last night with Iran's President Rouhani, along with a number of other American specialists in foreign policy. And what was your sense? Obviously, he didn't know about Trump's speech by then, but now he certainly does. But probably, I imagine Rouhani wouldn't have been surprised, right?
No, not at all. The Iranians are actually master negotiators and are quite skilled in this area. And this is completely independent of what you think of the government regime. It's a repressive government that is holding American citizens prisoner right now, we'd all like to see reforms and changes in that government. But his point at this dinner last night is one he's making consistently across his interviews, is that if the President of the United States pulls out of this agreement, it will greatly weaken U.S. credibility around the world and weaken the instrument of diplomacy. You can't have an international system where a country makes an agreement and then the next leader on their own whim then pulls out of that agreement. And when you think of it just for a minute, it's absolutely right. It's like making a mortgage with the bank and then having the bank cancel your mortgage because they have a new president. You know, and in so doing, Rouhani's tapping into the very deep concern of our closest allies. Just this week, there was a letter released by 70 European leaders, including, for example, Javier Solana, the former Secretary General of NATO. And they say in there that unilateral U.S. action that pulled out of this Iran agreement would be a grave mistake. It would harm U.S. interests and U.S. credibility around the world, because this is a deal that was negotiated not between the U.S. and Iran, but with the European allies, with the European Union, with Russia, with China, that went before the UN Security Council and was unanimously embraced, that is being implemented by Iran and by the United States. There are no violations of this deal. Iran is doing everything asked of it, and that's been confirmed by the international inspections under the International Atomic Energy Agency. So for the president to pull out on this, well, then it just ripples through the entire international security framework. How could North Korea possibly trust a deal that they would make with the United States? It undermines the possibility of a negotiated solution with North Korea, but it undermines the confidence our allies have. So this is the great sort of irony or of what Trump is doing in this effort to sound tough, to sort of bully other countries into doing what they want. He's isolating us. He's isolating the United States. He's weakening the diplomatic tools that have made the U.S. the leader of the Western world. And all of this goes to the benefit of, well, Iran. If Trump pulls out of this deal, Iran wins. The U.S. will be blamed, not Iran. The U.S. will be isolated, not Iran.
Well, just in closing, how do you see this unusual government that we have? I mean, obviously, Prime Minister Netanyahu would rather talk about Iran than the Palestinian issue. And you have Jared Kushner apparently supposedly going to solve the intractable Palestinian-Israeli peace situation. I wouldn't hold my breath on that. It does seem to me that you have here either amateurism or mendacity, or in fact a combination of both. But it does seem that, does the rest of the world understand that this is different, that the ship of state has never had such an erratic, unqualified, and perhaps dangerous helmsman?
Well, that's what many of the world leaders were hoping to get a sense of at the UN meeting. This is their chance to look at Trump up close. And all the reading so far, all the reports are that they're not impressed at what they're seeing. The more closely you look at President Trump's national security and foreign policy, the more you realize that there's nothing there, that it is a void. There is no grand plan. There is no consensus. He's undermining the very institutions of American diplomatic strength, cutting the budget of the State Department, not filling key positions, not placing ambassadors. He cut the budget of the UN delegation by 60%. There's a fraction this week. There's less than half of the normal U.S. diplomats up at the UN doing business. Now, world leaders are not impressed. What they're doing is recalculating. If the U.S. is really withdrawing from the world, and that's what it looks like, if it's bombast and tweets rather than diplomacy and international alliances, they're going to look elsewhere.
Well, Joseph Frinciani, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian. Pleasure to be on.
Likewise. And again, I've been speaking with Joseph Cirincione, the president of the Ploughshares Fund and the author of Bomb Scare, The History and Future of Nuclear Weapons. He worked on the professional staffs of the House Committee on Armed Services and the Committee on Government Operations and served as staff director of the Bipartisan Military Reform Caucus. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into whether the Russiagate dominoes are starting to fall.
But the atoms here, in spite of hysteria, it flourishes in Utah as well as Siberia. And whether you're a black, white, red, or brown, the question is this when you boil it down. To be or not to be, that's the question. The answer to it all ain't military datum, like who gets there firstest with the mostest atoms. No, the people of the world must decide their fate. They gotta get together or disintegrate. A whole list truth to be self-evident that all men may be cremated equal.
From Russia with love, I fly to you, much wiser since my goodbye to you.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Robert Dreyfus, a Nation contributing editor and an independent investigative journalist who specializes in politics and national security. He's the author of Devil's Game, How the United States Helped Unleash Fundamentalist Islam. And he has an article at Rolling Stone, Russiagate Dominoes Are Starting to Fall. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Dreyfus.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
And the New York Times story that reveals exactly what happened when the FBI raided Paul Manafort's home in the early hours of the morning, executing a FISA warrant on behalf of the special counsel, reads like something out of a movie. But there was also another raid as well. A FISA warrant was issued and the FBI executed a raid on Facebook itself to get all of this information about the extent to which Russians had created fake Americans to influence the elections using Facebook's as a vehicle for their active measures. So I take it that there's no other way to look at this except the special prosecutor's on a roll, right? And he's playing hardball.
Well, they've moved things into another gear over the last few weeks, and it did start in July with that raid on Manafort's home in Alexandria, Virginia. What we now know from the New York Times story is that they didn't knock on his door politely and ask if they could come in. This was a pre-dawn raid, and they got a warrant that specifically allowed them to fiddle with the lock to come in secretly. So I guess the first knock that Manafort heard was when they knocked on his bedroom door. They carted away all kinds of documents and electronic devices and boxes full of information. But it seems that they've identified Manafort as one of the weak links on Team Trump, that if they can bring him down, if they can connect him either to money laundering, to other financial and real estate crimes, or to Russia and election tampering, of course, that then he might flip and tell everybody on the Mueller side of the fence what's going on, and they could use him as a, you know, way to get to the higher-ups, including the main higher-up, the higher-up-in-chief, the president.
Yes, and Manafort was, after all, Donald Trump's campaign manager, and was present at that infamous meeting that took place in Trump's Tower in June of 2016, at which Jared Kushner and Donald Trump Jr. met with a whole bunch of Russians, most of whom had well-demonstrated and long-standing connections to Russian intelligence. But it looks as though the CIA was on to Manafort back in 2014, that they were looking into his activities in Ukraine on behalf of Yanukovych, the deposed.
Yeah, well, you know, Manafort had connections into Ukraine and to the pro-Russian politicians, specifically in Ukraine, going back 13 years. Starting in 2004, he was consulting for and doing political work on behalf of Viktor Yanukovych, who was eventually elected president of Ukraine once again back in the, I guess, around 2010 or so. And Yanukovych and his cronies were paying Manafort and his consulting firm, Davis Manafort Partners. But we don't know back at that time, 10 years ago, whether the intelligence community was picking up on Manafort just in the course of following the activities of various Ukrainians and Russians out there. But we do know that starting in 2014, just 3 years ago, they sought and won a FISA-ordered court surveillance operation against Manafort, including, I guess, listening to all of his phone communications and emails. That went on for 2 years, and it was suspended last year in 2016, and then it was restarted again last year. It seems from the work that CNN has done in digging into this that it was restarted after the CIA started picking up signs of activity linking Russian officials and business people with people from Team Trump, including Manafort. And so they reinstituted this warrant in 2016, and apparently it continued through this year. In fact, it continued even after Trump was inaugurated as President of the United States, so that theoretically, at least, it could be that the feds have transcripts of phone conversations between Manafort and the President of the United States, which could theoretically implicate either or both of them in talking about cooperation, colluding, coordinating with the Russians during the election campaign. That remains to be seen, but certainly Manafort is in a heap of trouble. And as we know, he's, according to the New York Times, he's been informed after that raid that he is going to be indicted. What he's going to be indicted for, that we don't know. But it certainly means indicted for some kind of criminal activity, which could range from, again, from financial wrongdoing all the way up to treasonous activities.
And again, I'm speaking with Robert Dreyfuss, a Nation contributing editor and independent investigative journalist who specializes in politics and national security. He's the author of Devil's Game, How the United States Helped Unleash Fundamentalist Islam. And he has an article at Rolling Stone, Russiagate Dominoes Are Starting to Fall. And of course, it's this is a way that federal prosecutors operate. They squeeze the weakest link, the lowest fruit. And it seems like they probably have an awful lot on Manafort, and he could be facing a lot of jail time, so maybe he will squeal. He certainly was fired unceremoniously by Jared Kushner, who gave him, I think, 30 seconds before he had to submit his resignation, and it was apparently quite humiliating for him. But just to touch on the activities that may have gained the attention of the CIA and led to these wiretappings, his businesses, Manafort's businesses with the Russians and with their puppet Yanukovych in Ukraine, and of course the whole Ukraine thing blew up when Viktor Yanukovych was deposed by his own people. Manafort had pocketed about $17 million from Yanukovych before then. But the other person who also pocketed money was who was a partner with Manafort in working on the Ukrainian account, on Yanukovych's account, was none other than Tad Devine, who ended up running Bernie Sanders' presidential campaign. So this is a very murky story, is it not?
Well, it's a tangled story, no doubt. And Mueller, the special counsel, has the ability to go every which way. Once he's installed as special counsel, his mandate is not unlimited, but it's pretty hard to tell him that he can't follow this or that lead. And I'm sure he'll, you know, look into everybody. The Podesta group has some connections to Ukraine as well, and so forth. But I mean, I think what he's going to try to do is follow each one of these threads and then see if it can get him closer to and not further away from the main target, which is, did the Trump campaign and its inner circle, his sons, his daughter, his son-in-law, his campaign manager, and some of his other intimates, did they coordinate with the Russians? The fact of the Russian meddling is pretty clearly established. I don't think Mueller has to further elucidate that, although it would be good if either he or the Senate and House committees that are looking into this made some of the intelligence public, if they declassified some of the underlying intelligence, so we know what the conclusion of the intelligence community was actually based on. But even short of that, I think Mueller's main job right now is determine whether somebody on the Trump campaign was wittingly or unwittingly involved in helping the Russians, whether it involves the hacking of the Democratic National Committee or Podesta's account, whether it involves the transmitting of that information, the leaking of it, whether it involves using their big data connections to help the Russians target things like Facebook ads and Twitter bots and other communication efforts that were aimed at deliberately inciting some of the Trump supporters to go out and vote last year. All of this stuff is what Mueller has to look into.
Well, that's why it is such an extraordinary, broad, multifaceted operation, apparently. I'm told that the operation that was ordered by Putin against the advice of some of his more seasoned advisors, like Ivanov, his chief of staff, who he fired because Ivanov didn't go along with it. He was a former KGB general, and Putin was a colonel. There's some buyer's remorse going on there now, but apparently it's cost about $5 billion at least. And I think when you look at the job that Mueller has, the only way to tie all of these threads together is to see it as an intelligence operation, which is what it was.
Well, that's true, although I don't think Mueller has to, you know, get every T crossed and every I dotted. He has to find evidence of, a few important crimes that he can then use to indict Trump-related officials and then hopefully get them to squeal on the boss. And at that point, he can make a recommendation to Congress that Trump be impeached. So, he's not writing the Encyclopedia Britannica about the scope and breadth and depth of this Russian investigation, although that would be nice to have. He's got to nail some people. And, just as Al Capone went to prison for tax cheat activities, I don't care if he gets the Trump people on crooked real estate deals or anything else. That's all fair game. And we can sort out the pieces of the Russian investigation later on. Now, I do know them from having talked to members of Congress recently that they consider their responsibility in part now to prepare defenses against this so it doesn't happen in the future. And that's a much trickier and broader question about how do you preserve and defend the 2018 and 2020 elections, and how do you crack down on improper use of social media without suppressing free speech and without infringing on First Amendment rights of organizations like Facebook and Twitter and their members.
Well, but what we're just learning is that Robert Mueller obtained a FISA warrant and the FBI did raid Facebook and they took these Russian accounts. Recently, Facebook announced that they had uncovered all of these Russian accounts with fake Americans trying to influence the election and also trying to organize rallies in Idaho, etc. It's obvious to me that Facebook wasn't coming clean. They were forced to admit it because the FBI raided them.
Yeah, the Facebook story, I think, is just at the very early stages. I think we have a lot more to learn about that. Adam Schiff, a congressman from California who's on the House Intelligence Committee, said we just know the tip of the iceberg on this story. Facebook said that it shut down a few hundred accounts involving Russian operatives during the 2016 election. But we learned recently that in the French election, the French shut down 50,000 Russian accounts on Facebook. So the idea that this was limited to $100,000 worth of ads and a few hundred accounts, I think, is not credible. Facebook has not released, even to Senate and House investigators, the precise ads that were posted on Facebook. They have not identified to either the House or Senate intelligence committees the names of the Russians. The Russians created fake American-sounding names, you know, from places like West Virginia and Kansas, and made them pretend to be Americans while they were yapping on Facebook about how terrible Hillary Clinton was. So, and as you mentioned, organizing anti-immigration rallies. And so we just know the beginning of this story. Mueller, no doubt, can get more, but I think it's going to be like pulling teeth. You know, he can subpoena material from Facebook, but how do you know that you've got all of it? How do you get, you know, Facebook people to cooperate completely? And do the Facebook people even know? I don't know. I mean, they've got billions of members. They make a lot of money the more members they have. They don't want to scare people away. The same thing goes for Twitter. I think we've just begun to learn about that. I mean, Twitter isn't as careful as Facebook. You don't have to identify who you are. But some huge percentage, I've seen different numbers on this, but a huge percentage of Twitter users are fake. They're just bots. They're robots that spew out propaganda. And you can create dozens or hundreds or thousands of these with a few clicks of a mouse, if you know what you're doing, and, you know, create trending topics on Twitter and do all kinds of things to foster conspiracy theories like the Pizzagate nonsense and other things that happened last year. So I think we're just beginning to learn the importance of the potential Russian involvement in both Facebook and Twitter.
Well, Robert Dreyfus, I thank you very much for joining us here today. I appreciate it.
Thanks, been my pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Robert Dreyfus, who's a Nation contributing editor and an independent investigative journalist who specializes in politics and national security. He's the author of Devil's Game, How the United States Helped Unleash Fundamentalist Islam. And he has an article at Rolling Stone, Russiagate Dominoes Are Starting to Fall. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back looking at this last-ditch effort to repeal and replace Obamacare that may well be the worst Republican bill so far.
Doctor, my eyes have seen the years and the slow parade of fears without crying. Now I want to understand. I have done all that I could to see the evil and the good without hiding. You must help me if you can. Doctor,
welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Wendell Potter, the author of Deadly Spin, an insurance company insider, speaks out on how corporate PR is killing healthcare and deceiving Americans. After a long career in the for-profit health industry as chief corporate spokesman at Cigna and as head of corporate communications at Humana, he's now a senior analyst on healthcare at the Center for Public Integrity and the founder of Tarbell.org. His latest book is Nation on the Take, How Big Money Corrupts Our Democracy and What We Can Do About It. And he has an op-ed at Truthout. Even business leaders are realizing health insurance companies serve no purpose. Welcome to Background Briefing, Wendell Potter.
Ian, thank you.
Well, your article is welcome, and it's about time. Somehow we got it through the heads of Americans that you don't need the insurance companies in the healthcare business, and apparently a lot of big CEOs are realizing it because it's not making them competitive right. with the rest of the world. But that doesn't mean that they don't have enormous political clout. And here you have this last-minute, last-ditch attack on the part of the Republicans in the Senate to repeal and replace Obamacare, the so-called Graham-Cassidy bill. And, you know, it looks like they might be able to pull it off unless there's a tremendous outpouring of outrage across the country. They're pushing hard, and the two senators that voted against the last incarnation of repeal and replace, and this one apparently, this latest one's even worse, Murkowski and McCain are wavering.
Right. They are, and it's, which is very troubling. This even, I think, the governor of Alaska, where Murkowski is from, has grave misgivings about this bill because it would do great harm to his state and to Alaskans. McCain has kind of warmed up to this, but he's been saying that he objects to pushing this through without hearings. In other words, just ignoring the normal Senate procedures, which is exactly what they're trying to do. This legislation hasn't been scored, as they say, by the Congressional Budget Office, so there's no way of knowing in advance before they vote on this bill what the economic consequences would be and how many people would lose their coverage. So it's just it's a horrible, horrible piece of legislation. And as you look at it, it's even worse than some of the things that have been proposed before.
Well, they are having a hearing, but it's before the Senate Homeland Security Committee. So who could take that seriously?
Oh, for exactly right. I mean, this is the committees that should have a hearing. One is the committee that's chaired by Senator Lamar Alexander of Tennessee, the Health, Education, Labor, and Pension Committee, which has jurisdiction over these matters typically. And, of course, the Senate Finance Committee has the ultimate responsibility for yay and nay on most things of this nature and holding hearings. And Alexander has been working with Senator Patty Murray of Washington to try to see if there might be some bipartisan solution, or at least bipartisan legislation that could be drafted and supported by both Democrats and Republicans to improve the Affordable Care Act, not get away with it, but try to see what can be done to strengthen the marketplace, I think, is their main objective. It's just a mockery of the legislative process. Graham and Cassidy just apparently want to get this through to say that they've done it.
Well, it's a little hard to take, you know, that Cassidy is this doctor from Louisiana. He's also a fundamentalist Christian like Mike Pence. And, you know, what they're doing is so cruel and unchristian. It's just extraordinary. We don't know what Graham's motivations are. We know that he's a friend of McCain's, and obviously he's leaning on McCain. As you mentioned, McCain wants to go back to regular order, but on the other hand, they're pushing hard. You know, and then on the Democratic side, they just had a big photo op about going to single payer with Bernie Sanders and I think 15 other Democrats. And at the time, some Democrats, Sherrod Brown and others, were saying, you know, let's not keep our eye off the ball here. They still want to repeal and replace Obamacare. We can't fight two battles at once, otherwise we lose both. And now I get all these pitches from conservative public relations firm offering up interviews, and now the spin on the right wing is you've got to support Graham Cassidy because if it fails, then we'll have single payer. So there you have it.
I think Graham has said it's federalism or socialism, to try to be a bit pithy if you're Lindsey Graham. And by federalism, what this bill is all about is really stripping the federal government of almost any authority of having anything to do with our healthcare system, and handing almost everything to the states, and block granting, as they say, the Medicaid program, reducing the funding for it. It would result in so many people losing their coverage, and states that have expanded Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act losing funding. It would be a horrible redistribution of funds around the country. States like California would be the biggest loser. New York would also be a big loser, because both states, big populations, and they have expanded the Medicaid program. Other big states that have done that, even Ohio, which has a Republican governor, a number of Republican governors have said this doesn't make sense.
Well, but this is what's so bizarre and surreal about this Cassidy Graham bill, is that you're punishing states that took Medicaid expansion and you're rewarding states who didn't. And we know that the states who refused Obama's Medicaid expansion did it for ideological reasons, and now they're going to be rewarded. And Cassidy, the good Christian, is lying through his teeth, saying that all the money goes to California and not to the other state. Well, the reason it does is that you ideologues in these other states refuse to get aboard a program because it was led by a black man that you had this irrational hatred towards.
I don't disagree with you, Ian. And I've talked to a number of people who just simply cannot understand why they're doing this, except to try to fulfill a campaign promise, because it is such bad legislation and it would do such harm to people who live in red states and blue states. And the consequences, I think the political consequences would be great for the Republican Party. I think negative consequences. Can you imagine the heart-wrenching stories that will be told, and the media will tell them of how, and not just that, constituents will experience these hardships, these horror stories. I cannot see how Republicans see how they can win. If this were to pass, it would be, I think, really bad for that party. I just simply don't get it. And maybe they think that they are such good communicators that they will be able to point the finger of blame away from them, from the chaos that would ensue. But I just don't think they can pull that off.
Well, they can pull it off if the public and the press don't let people know what's really going on. And as you say, the bill's not going to be scored by the CBO. And it obviously is being pushed through so they can get a win and look as if the Republicans can govern, because this healthcare debacle has been a real black eye for them. I understand their political motives. And it comes down to, you know, Susan Collin, Rand Paul, Lisa Murkowski, and John McCain. All they have to do is peel off a couple, and with the vice president's vote, Obamacare is dead. So there's an awful lot.
That's true.
Awful lot at stake here. And so just I want to talk to you about your article on how the CEOs in this country are starting to look into why we should get insurance companies out of healthcare. But just to finish up on this issue, which I think is critical, because they want to push it through by September the 30th. It's probably a worse bill than any of the other ones, but it's not being framed that way. These are supposed to be, you know, the moderate senators who want to be effective and get things done. It's a total lie. So what can be done to stop this? Because we've only got a couple of U.S. senators who are Republicans to work with, and obviously they're getting leaned on by their Republican caucus.
They are, and you're right. It hasn't been framed as it should be. I think that hopefully will begin to change as more in the media begin to really come to understand what's in this bill. It's confusing, and I, you know, there are a few people who truly understand both the Affordable Care Act and what this bill would do, and I think they're beginning to speak out. It takes a bit of time. I think that you will start, hopefully, seeing more media coverage that really is truthful about what this legislation will actually do. Health policy is extraordinarily, as you know, Ian, complicated. Any kind of reform legislation can be very confusing and easily misrepresented. And I think that we have that situation here for sure right now. And hopefully we'll start seeing Democrats and others start talking about how devastating this will be if it goes through. And we'll just have to see. Because if they don't, it is just going to be catastrophic.
Well, just in the last minute, tell us about the piece you've written at Truth Out.
I wrote it, the piece in Truth Out to just to help people understand that we will eventually have some different kind of reform to truly transform this healthcare system. What we've had so far, and even this bill, the Graham-Cassidy bill, is built around our multi-payer system. And that's just not sustainable. When I say that, it's a system that we have in this country that is really controlled by multiple insurance companies, private insurance companies, that really cannot control cost. And as I pointed out in this piece, they don't really have incentive to control cost because as healthcare costs go up, they get more revenue, and that they can convert to profits and satisfy their shareholders. And a lot of CEOs are finally coming around to realize this, that they've been sold a bill of goods by insurance companies over many, many years, and they're seeing how they're paying for it with constantly increasing premiums. And they've come to the realization that they can, big corporations in particular, are realizing they don't need them. They're beginning to contract directly with big hospitals in the areas where they have large concentrations of employees. So they're cutting out the middleman. And I think as that becomes more and more common, the country is going to come to realize, well, if these business people are saying that these insurance companies are an unnecessary middleman, why do we need them for the rest of us? So I think that's what's going to begin to change as business leaders start to speak up and get involved in this and say our current system makes no sense. It's costing us money and making our companies uncompetitive on the global in the global economy.
Well, Wendell Potter, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
My pleasure, Ian. Thank you.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Wendell Potter, who after a long career in the for-profit health industry as chief corporate spokesman at Cigna and as head of corporate communications at Humana, is now a senior analyst on healthcare at the Center for Public Integrity and the founder of Tarbell.org. And he has an article at Truth Out, Even Business Leaders Are Realizing Health Insurance Companies Serve No Purpose. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.